Hi, this is Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore.
As auto emissions standards tighten around the world, auto manufacturers are ramping up research and development of hydrogen fuel cells. General Motors announced a new 7-year joint effort with Honda to develop such vehicles. It's the latest in a series of similar alliances involving manufacturers. Current State, it has a guest joining us now to help us understand the technology involved. Scott Calabrese Barton is an associate professor of chemical engineering and material science at Michigan State.
Thank you very much.
I mentioned earlier stricter auto emission standards in the introduction to this piece. Is this the primary push for the hydrogen fuel cell? It's primarily emissions in the environment?
Yeah, there's really two contexts that are going on here. Emissions in the environment are driving technologies that don't burn fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm.
And the fuel cells that are being designed for automotive applications use hydrogen, which doesn't have any carbon in it, so it doesn't have any CO2 emissions directly, at least. And it has relatively few other types of harmful emissions, no sulfur emissions, no nitrogen oxide emissions, has relatively little impact on ozone, for example. So yes, the environmental context is one, but there's also the context of sources of energy and maintaining sources of energy that are domestic, lowering our reliance on petroleum is another context that's really driving this.
Okay. And I also referred to the fact that the emission standards worldwide are increasing. How noticeable a trend is that? Can you speak to that?
Well, that isn't my area. I think probably some of the environmental engineers might be able to answer that better than me.
Okay.
But I do know that that the demands on automakers are growing all the time, and that requires a little bit of creativity and really thinking outside the box in order to meet those demands. And I think fuel cells are a great example of thinking outside the box.
Let's dig a little bit deeper into the fuel cell technology here in layman's terms, if at all possible. Give us a very basic description of how a hydrogen fuel cell vehicle actually gets propelled down the road.
Sure. Well, a fuel cell vehicle is really an evolution of the hybrid vehicles that we already see on the road.
Okay.
It starts with putting a battery pack in the vehicle that can sit either in parallel or between the engine and the wheels, and allow for things like regenerative braking, where when you apply the brakes, you're actually taking the kinetic energy from the vehicle's motion and turning that back into electrical energy. And there's a lot of other efficiencies that can come with that. And all we're talking about with a fuel cell vehicle is really keeping the same hybrid approach and replacing the internal combustion engine, which generally would burn gasoline, with a different system that can consume, instead of gasoline, a more environmentally friendly fuel like hydrogen.
You're saying I'm really curious about the first point you made. Are you saying that hydrogen fuel cell vehicles are going to be able to take energy from braking and actually reassign that energy?
Well, it will be a hybrid vehicle. It will have some sort of, it'll either be a battery system, most likely, or a capacitor that will be able to act as a buffer between the fuel cell and the actual wheels, and allow energy to flow in both directions. So all the technology that's going into hybrid vehicles now will be applied to fuel cell vehicles as well.
Now, this is, from my understanding, this will still be an electric vehicle. It's just that all the electricity is generated by combining hydrogen and oxygen?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
And where would the hydrogen come from?
That's an excellent question. So from an environmental standpoint, there's a lot of emissions that you'd like to avoid, but you'd also would like to avoid carbon dioxide emissions in order to minimize, the global warming effect. And hydrogen, from the narrow perspective of the car itself, can do that, because when hydrogen is oxidized, it forms water. But you have to get the hydrogen from somewhere. And right now, the lion's share of hydrogen comes from natural gas. And so you can convert methane to hydrogen. And if fuel cell vehicles hit the road, most of the hydrogen will come from natural gas. One of the enabling factors with fuel cells right now is the fact that the price of natural gas is dropped a lot because of new techniques for taking it out of the ground. So natural gas is relatively cheap. That enables relatively cheap hydrogen, and that could very well enable fuel cell vehicles to hit the road.
I'm curious, does this debate over hydraulic fracturing end up impacting your studies?
Absolutely.
Indirectly, I would think it would.
Yeah, absolutely. That is a common technique for removing natural gas from the ground, and that natural gas can be used to make hydrogen.
And is there liquefied hydrogen that people would put back into their hydrogen fuel cells then? Is this a liquefied thing?
Well, I think the common technology now is pressurized hydrogen. That's one of the big challenges for fuel cells, is how to carry the hydrogen around. The nice thing about hydrogen is that it's very light. It's the lightest element, and it really has been a big enabler for things like the space shuttle, which runs almost entirely on hydrogen fuel. But when it comes to putting it in a car, that lightness is a disadvantage because it takes up a lot of space. So you have to pressurize it in order to and make the volume of the hydrogen gas much lower in order to fit it into a vehicle. So right now the tanks are high pressure tanks that have tens or hundreds of atmospheres worth of hydrogen in the tanks. Liquefaction is another alternative, but that tends to be heavier and more expensive and more complicated. So I think the standard approach now is pressurized tanks.
We're talking with Dr. Scott Calabrese Barton, who is an associate professor of chemical engineering and material science here at Michigan State University. We're talking about hydrogen fuel cells in the wake of another alliance to jointly study such vehicles that was announced last week between General Motors and Honda Motor. We seem to be dropping the term battery from the lexicon here and replacing it with fuel cell. Help us. Is there a critical difference to understand here between a fuel cell and a battery?
Yeah, a fuel cell is very similar to a battery in the sense that it has two electrodes. One has an oxidation reaction. In the case of fuel cells, it's oxidizing hydrogen, and the other one has a reduction reaction. In the case of fuel cells, we're reducing oxygen. The difference is that a fuel cell has a fuel tank, and all the energy for those two reactions come from a separate fuel tank. In a battery, all of the energy is contained within the battery itself. And if you want to have a battery that has more energy, if you want to double the energy of the battery, you double the size of the battery. With a fuel cell, instead of doubling the size of the fuel cell, you double the size of the tank. And so that's the big difference. And so fuel cells end up being much more efficient in terms of energy per unit mass and per unit volume when you get up to the scale of things like laptops and automobiles. It becomes a liability when you get down to the scale of things like cell phones, where you can see that batteries are still the dominant technology in those small electronic devices.
Okay. Scott, what is standing in the way of developing hydrogen fuel cell batteries? What are the key challenges here?
Well, at the beginning of the Obama administration, Stephen Chu, who was then the energy secretary, specified four what he called miracles that had to be overcome to make fuel cells possible. And two of those four miracles that really have been overcome. One was the source of the hydrogen. We talked about natural gas as being a source. That's a fairly recent development. The second miracle that's been more or less overcome is the storage issue, which we just talked about. Now the two major issues are distribution of hydrogen, essentially establishing an infrastructure of hydrogen stations where you can refuel the vehicle. And then the other big issue is the cost of the technology itself and making it cost competitive with internal combustion and now, you know, other battery-powered vehicles. So the real challenges are big ones. Infrastructure that requires a lot of cooperation and cost, which requires a lot of intellectual input. And I think those two, you know, big challenges are really driving this sort of cooperative trend that we've been seeing lately.
I understand platinum is required for hydrogen fuel cells, and that's an awfully precious metal.
That's right. That really goes to the cost issue. It's a precious metal, and that means that there's no economy of scale. If we start putting fuel cells in half the vehicles on the road, then the cost of platinum will go through the roof. We've already seen that a couple of times when there's been ramps up in the price of platinum because fuel cell technology threatened to become, a little bit more mainstream. And so that's a real challenge. And there's been a lot of work to minimize the amount of platinum that that goes into a fuel cell. I think once we get to the level of the amount of platinum that is put into a catalytic converter, which is for a typical car about a gram of platinum or so, then we'll be at the stage where the platinum issue will be no longer really driving things. But right now we're using about, I'd say, 10 grams of platinum per fuel cell, maybe 10 to 20, and that really is a big center of cost. It's not the only center of cost for fuel cells. There's lots of other materials that are quite expensive, and assembling the fuel cell can be expensive. But platinum is really about 30% of the cost of the fuel cell stack at this point.
That's quite a bit. There's one other point of fact that I wanted to get out here. In spite of the challenges that you've just enumerated here in making hydrogen fuel cells a reality, there are still two automakers who have apparently successfully are already making these cars. Honda is one of them, the Honda FCX Clarity, and Mercedes makes one as well, the Mercedes F cell. So somehow they have managed to overcome these things. That point may be outside your wheelhouse, but there are apparently manufacturers that are getting this done.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, that's not to say that they're actually making money by putting these on the road, because there's a certain benefit to being first to market. And I think they're really taking advantage of that. And a lot of automakers are very, very close to putting their own vehicles on the road. Toyota's promised to put one on the road by 2015. General Motors and Honda, as we've talked about it, have talked about selling these things by 2020. So
yeah.
So there's a lot of there is a lot of promise there, but I think the first thing that's going to happen is that the automakers will sell cars or lease cars at a loss. It's not going to be a profitable thing to do right away. And that's similar to what happened with hybrid vehicles, where Toyota and Ford had put vehicles on the road and really didn't necessarily make money on
it. And 100 other products, probably.
Yeah.
We've been talking about hydrogen fuel cells with Dr. Scott Calabrese Barton. He's an associate professor of chemical engineering and material science here at MSU. Thanks, Scott. Current State on 90.5 WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. Well, it may be hard to believe, but evidence suggests many otherwise benign, everyday items like flip-flops and drinking straws and neckties pose serious dangers. Other reputable data point to the health risks involved in common activities like flossing our teeth and washing our hands and eating leafy greens. Writer Christopher Cerf and his partner Henry Beard has chronicled, like never before, all of these disturbing but often absurd dangers. Cerf is the co-author of Encyclopedia Paranoica, which he claims, quote, might just save your life, but probably won't. Welcome, Chris Cerf.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
I am well. It's great to have you on board here. I stumbled onto your book at Schuler Books here in Okemos, and I had to get you on the show. I have to read a passage from the flyer of your book. The back jacket describes Encyclopedia Paranoica as the definitive compendium of things you absolutely, positively must not eat, drink, wear, take, grow, make, buy, use, do, permit, believe, or let yourself be exposed to, including an awful lot of toxic, lethal, horrible stuff that you thought was safe, good, or healthy. This suggests kind of an ongoing state of alarm. Are you naturally this kind of person, Chris Cerf, a neurotic worry wart?
Well, I am now, Mark. Henry Beard and I were not this way until we started researching this book, but we got more and more horrified the more work we did.
Was there a moment reading a health warning or something that triggered the thought, hey, we've got a book here?
Absolutely. More the thought was a book is necessary to keep it all straight, because all the advice, which is all based on scientific research, all that advice is totally contradictory. What really got us started, to answer your question, was an article that appeared on the internet, where we found a lot of this stuff, of course, about macular degeneration, the eye problem. There was a doctor in Australia who runs the Macular Degeneration Foundation there, who discovered that carrots caused macular degeneration. Therefore, carrots were bad for your eyes, not good for your eyes, and should be avoided at all costs. So that sort of rang a bell with us that we better look into it further. And the minute that I did, I read more from the doctor in Australia, who said that instead of carrots, we should eat spinach to make our eyes better, since spinach has lutein in it, but no dangerous beta carotenes. But unfortunately, we then found a doctor in London who said that spinach was terrible for you. Because spinach has a kind of acid in it, oxalic acid, that leaches the calcium out of your bones. So this doctor said, no more spinach, use dairy products instead. But of course, dairy products have lots of fat in them and cause your cholesterol counts to go up and all kinds of other horrible things. So there's no way out.
This brings to mind one of your previous books. I don't think it was written with Henry Beard, but it was about all of the expert disagreement that exists in the world, right?
That's absolutely right. Victor Nevasky from The Nation magazine and I have done a couple of editions of a book called The Experts Speak.
That's right.
Where we collected quotes from experts in the world on every subject throughout history, all of whom turned out to be completely wrong. And this project is very connected to that one, because all these experts are contradictory, if not wrong.
You chronicle five separate risks to health due to flip-flops. You claim that Today Show reporter Laura Coffey includes the possibility of death as one
right.
of them. They're unhealthy because, here are the five reasons. You tend to scrunch your toes, and when you repeat that, long-term ankle and hip problems may result. Two,
terrible.
No arch support. Three, toes and feet are exposed and easily stepped on. Four, melanoma. Sunburn due to exposure of the tops of the feet. That can be very painful. And five, they're apparently covered in bacteria. How has American society remained safe in light of the flip-flop danger here?
Well, I think, Mark, the only way it has is because everybody doesn't wear flip-flops every minute. If we all did, we'd be doomed. Sorry to have to be the bearer of ill tidings here all the time, but that's my role.
The book is an especially rich storehouse of alarm for any germaphobe. There are a lot of entries along the lines of this one, summarizing the risks of being treated by nurses with artificial nails. And this is from the Ann Arbor Veterans Hospital just down the road.
Yes, I was going to say that's right from your home state.
Yeah. 73% of the nurses with fake nails had harmful pathogens present on their nails, compared with only 32% of nurses with native nails. And even after washing with an antimicrobial soap, the fake nail wearers continued to be more likely, by 68% to 22%, to be harboring dangerous microbes and yeasts. There are germs everywhere. That is probably one of the biggest takeaways from your book.
Well, that's true. And, of course, the good advice about the artificial nails is, if you're in the emergency room, even if you think you're having a heart attack or something, and the nurse that comes out to greet you is wearing artificial nails, you better get out of there.
It seems to me there is a great deal of perfectly logical advice about the risks of ordinary activities and objects in your book, but there is something about 380 pages of them that makes you never want to take another sensible precaution for the rest of your life. You can only laugh when all of this is presented in front of you.
Well, that's what we're hoping, of course. I guess you could say Encyclopedia Paranoica, even though it's very useful, is a work of satire. And I think we just realized that the media has kind of gone overboard, reporting every incredible danger every day because it makes for good headlines, whereas saying, you know, spinach is pretty good for you is not a big news story.
Right. What's the response to the book been? I mean, who exactly do you hear from after you write a book like this?
Well, the gamut is wide. There are a lot of people who take it very seriously and then get mad at us and say, you know, that we made it all up, which we didn't, by the way. Every single item in this book is carefully footnoted to prove that somebody said it. And usually it's research people who probably got money for the research, perhaps from companies that might have some interest in the results. For example, a lot of the germ stuff, a lot of the research we have there was financed by the Clorox company. So, of course, they have some interest in scaring you to death so you'll buy more bleach. But, of
right.
course, the soap people say that the bleach is dangerous and you should use soap instead. In fact, there are two rival doctors, in a sense, who completely agree about the danger, one at NYU and one at the University of Arizona. But the Arizona guy thinks you should use bleach, and the New York guy thinks you should use soap. So guess who funded whom?
Yeah. Well, writer Christopher Cerf and his partner Henry Beard are co-authors of Encyclopedia Paranoica. It might just save your life, but probably won't. Thanks, Chris Cerf.
Thank you, Mark. This was fun.
It's halftime at Current State. Stay with us for a conversation with MSU head football coach Mark D'Antonio, with MSU president Luana Simon, and athletic director Mark Hollis. Then it's information graphics from Carl Goode and the Michigan Historical Museum's Put It on Paper exhibit. I'm Mark Bayshore. Stay with us on Current State. This is Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. MSU President Luana Simon and Athletic Director Mark Hollis regularly anchor AM 870's MSU Today. Their interviews are an occasional feature here on Current State. Simon and Hollis recently caught MSU football coach Mark D'Antonio away from the gridiron to talk about families, health, and athletics in our society.
Well, first of all, I think you just want to keep your children involved. I think if you can keep them involved throughout the course of their adolescent life, you know, you've got things in the right perspective. So whether it's football, whether it's soccer or basketball or tennis or cross country or any of the sports or any basically any type of alternative things other than school, I think you've got a chance to keep them on the right road. So that's the first thing. When you look at football, though, I think young people are playing football. I started playing in the second grade way back. I don't know if my pants fit or whatever, but that's when I started playing, and I think that it's a little bit later now. I think a lot of people are concerned about the safety issues, but I do think that that there's adequate padding and the collisions aren't as aren't as, they're not like collisions in high school or in college or in the NFL. They're at a lower rate of speed. So I think it is a safe sport. And find a great coach and find people that care about young people and not so much about the winning and losing, but about playing the game and learning the game and really having a good time with it.
I think some of the challenges you see as a parent when you're raising kids and having two boys and a daughter, I think it's the same, you know, same for both, is the specialization. It's focusing your kids on one sport to exceed all expectations versus giving a variety and trying to do a little bit of everything, kind of the way that you grew up. But it seems like we live in a specialized world today in so many different aspects of our lives, and that's really penetrated into, I think, the way that kids are being brought up. They're being asked to just focus on soccer or just focus on football. And, you know, I understand the value in some of that, but at the same time, providing broad opportunities, especially with the younger ages. Do you see that?
Yeah, absolutely right. I played, you know, growing up, I was involved in football, basketball, and then track as well. So I switched sports every 3 or 4 months. And I think that was the norm back then. I don't think that's the case these days. And that's a cause for alarm because you get pushed, and then sometimes young people get left behind because you got the club soccer and you got the different things and the higher levels of things. And you know, if you're not continuing to succeed, and that's a very small percentage, a lot of young people get left behind. And I think that's where the problem lies. And, you know, I was recently on a Nike trip, and they talked about the aspect that for the first time in history, where we're in modern history, that our young people are scheduled to die 5 years earlier than we are, and that's from a lack of basic exercise.
Activity, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's great for that young person to continue to succeed and go to a high level of soccer or basketball or football, but you have a lot of others that just need to be involved and need to continue to have great experiences to become involved. So what I've tried to do with our football team, even at this level, is to make sure that everybody that's on our football team has value and brings value to our team. And, you know, that's tough with 105, 110 players, but we really try hard to give everybody a reason for being there and a reason to create passion in what they're doing. Because if you've got to stay fully engaged, there's no question you've got to stay fully engaged.
I think that's a great point. I co-chair the Governor's Fitness Council with Dave Brandon, and one of the challenges there is, you know, the kid who just sits in the stand, or even worse, the kid who just sits in front of a screen, and it's multiple screens. It goes, you know, you tell your children to put the phone down, and then they're picking up their iPad, and you tell them to put that down, and they're watching TV or going onto the computer, and it's how do you motivate kids to step away from that world, that fictional world that I like to call it, and get out and do something active. You know, I asked my son yesterday to go out and shovel snow, and his reply is, it's too wet, too heavy, can't do it. And it's motivating kids to get over that edge that, you know, hard work is rewarded, hard work is good. And that's a challenge, but staying active is so, so important with young children.
You know, I tweeted from I was on this Nike trip, so I tweeted from there, you know.
It's a big thing.
Just active now on that. But I did do that, and, you know, I hashtagged designed to move. And everybody thought we were getting new uniforms and et cetera.
Right.
But, you know, if people will go on to, you know, Nike designed to move and watch that video, it'll speak to what I just talked about. And it's alarming. And so when we talk about young people, we talk about people that are, you know, 10, 11 years old, just getting them out there and keeping them active and keeping them involved. And that's why when you're a coach, and hopefully a lot of people that are hearing this are coaching young people, very young people, it's so important for them to have a good experience. The video that you sent me about the young person from El Paso, you know, the high school player from El Paso, that just speaks to that. But it's so important that they have a positive experience and they grow from that and they stay passionate about what they're doing. And you know, hopefully they exercise for life.
When I was at a residence hall recently, I got students all these questions, and I said, "Well, do you all have pickup games?" He said, sure, we go have video games. And so we have people all over the world who we play with. And so their definition of a pickup game is sort of the video version of it, and you have all these people, and it's really fun. And I was thinking, well, it really is sort of going outside and finding five people to play
with. Nation of great condition thumbs, I think. Yes.
Let me sort of shift gears a bit, and we talk a lot about sport being a way of creating leaders. But it just doesn't happen overnight. So as a coach, as your coaching staff, how do you think about, you know, making people leaders? Because not everybody can be a captain, but everybody has to be responsible and sort of lead others during difficult times. So what are some of the things that you do to help spark those leadership skills?
You know, what we ask our players to do, what we do with, as a team, actually, is we vote on our 12 top leaders throughout the year five or six different times. So that's a constantly type of situation. They're moving in and out of leadership positions, and they've got to maintain that. But you know, even as far as our freshmen, as they come in, we're trying to put people in charge of different things and create adversity. And I think leaders are born out of adverse situations, and they're sort of thrust into it. I don't think anybody can sort of choose and walk in the room and say, I'm going to be the leader here. You can appoint it sometimes, but, you know, I don't know if that'll, you know, even if you pick a head coach, that may not last over a certain point in time. Hopefully this one will. But
we intend to have you here for a very, very long time. I'm going to be hunched over with a cane going to Spartan Stadium to watch you coach.
That'll be exciting. Anyway, but, you know, I think our guys are thrust into leadership positions, you know, in times of adversity, and they grow underneath that. And, you know, that's what's great about college football and this level of football. And when you come here, you have a chance to play at this level, and, you know, hopefully you're creating lifetime moments for them and lifetime experiences, and they can carry over and become self-sufficient men. By doing those things, they've been under such intense pressure that when they have to go in front of an interview or do something later on in life, that this has prepared them for that. But we're constantly talking about leadership. I think that's the key to success. If you have great leaders, you're going to succeed, because that creates great chemistry.
When you hear the phrase college football, college sports, NCAA, student athlete, what are some of the thoughts that come to your mind about the industry that we work in, the values, maybe some of the aspirations on where you'd like to see evolution in the future? But, you know, there's so many great things about college sports. I'd like to know what comes to the top of your mind when you hear.
Well, when you hear it, when I hear NCAA, whatever sport it is, I think a high achievement. I think it, you know, other than the professional level, the highest level that you can possibly get. You know, when you talk about Division I college football, high level, a lot of pressure, a lot of excitement, a lot of media exposure, things that everybody dreams. You know, and really that's what you're dreaming for when you're that young person that I talked about earlier.
I think, I kind of view our jobs as opportunities for young men and women to come in and leave better people. And that can be athletically, but it also can be academically, socially, mentally, how well they're adjusted as an individual. And there's a lot of pressure at times to pull you toward what I would term more of an athletic professional venue that you're operating in. And, you know, I don't think at times everyone understands the thought process that goes through in making decisions on all of those spectrums. On discipline, on punishment, on achievement. And those are things that I've sat back and watched you deliberate over with the intent of making the individual a better person at the end of the day. And I don't know if you have any comments on that, but I think you're fabulous at looking at the big picture and the perspective and coming out on the other side with a positive outcome.
Well, thanks, Mark. You know, I started coaching way back, or decided that I wanted to be a coach, because the coaches that I had impacted me as a person. And this goes back to when I was young, a 10-year-old or 11 or 12. And it's continued really throughout. And then I was fortunate to be around coaches as I grew professionally, fortunate around coaches when I was a college player. But because of that, our goals really have been shaped around having a relationship with our players for the rest of their life. And I think if you just take that one little statement and do that, then you know that It doesn't mean they've succeeded athletically, but it means that you've been there in the tough times for them and you tried to help them overachieve and try and do something with their life. We want to help them launch their career as individuals, whether that's in professional sports or whether that's in business or teaching or something else, but we want to help them launch their career. I think that it's very important that they get their degree, so that's a big part of this. And, you know, obviously we want to win and win championships and all the things that are exciting with that, but we want them to have a platform as they leave here. And if they can do those things, those four things, you know, they're hopefully going to be around, you know, a little bit rounded as a person. And again, you look back and you ask yourself, what are you? You're a mentor, you're a teacher, whether you're the president of the university or whether you're the athletic director. You're here for young people. And that's why you got involved in this type of environment that we're in, this educational environment. And I think of myself as an educator, not as a coach, but as an educator.
I want to shift gears away from that. And now that you're a part of the social media, I must admit I'm not. So I'm the Neanderthal in this group. How are you reacting to all of this sort of sense that people are interested in these little 5-minute, you know, blurbs that go all over the world and people are hanging for the next one?
You know, it's an interesting concept, I can tell you that. You know, I don't tweet that often, but when I do tweet, you know, it is me. And I'm not going to have somebody else do that for me. And, you know, I did think that I initially got involved with it because I thought it would be a way to get information out a little bit. And then also, you know, the landscape continues to change and you have to do the things we just talked about, but you also have to try and stay on the cutting edge and you have to reach out to possible recruits and young people. And so that's what we'll do with it. But it is interesting. You know, it's just it's an instant world that I've, you know, it's so different from the world that I grew up in, and it's a world of instant information. And you have to try and keep pace with it, whether you're in education or business or athletics.
Mark's the one who's our
I slowed down for a little bit, but I'm back. I'm back. You've accomplished things that have never been accomplished here at Michigan State, the program, you, your assistant coaches. What do you attribute that success to, and what do you see out there in the future as far as Spartan football?
Well, we've got great continuity on our staff. We've had a couple changes this year, but for the most part, the core of who we are as a staff has remained the same. So players come, they have an opportunity to learn in the same system, and because they're learning in the same system, they get more proficient at it. That's the game plan. And again, I think we're trying to meet those goals we talked about, so we're trying to be fair and consistent with our players. And, you know, we just try and finish things. But I think, you know, why we've been successful is really one word. I mean, chemistry. Mm-hmm. Chemistry with our office and the president, chemistry in the athletic program department, you know, with Coach Izzo, yourself, and all the other coaches, and support from, you know, I remember the first day I came here and to become the head football coach, and I remember saying that if we could just all go in one direction, if we don't splinter away and go in one direction, that we can be very successful here. And, you know, we've had our moments where we've read right on, you know, we've teetered and then we'd fall the opposite way. But, you know, we've had some good moments here too, but I think it's chemistry. I think it's our players' chemistry. They reach the young players when they come in. They talk to them about how it's going to be done. They have a great deal of pride in what they're doing. We've tried to minimize pretty much our off-field problems. We've had some. But we've minimized them.
As I said, they're kids.
Yeah. But we've minimized them, especially as of late. And the chemistry that we have as a group, you know, fosters positive thinking.
Well, I think when I have the task of going out to hire a coach, I put a lot of science, I put a lot of data, and I put a lot of research.
Did he have spreadsheets?
Into every hire. But at the end of the day, what I look at is the eyes of my three children and think about what I want this individual to be around my kids. And as you go through the coaches that I've had an opportunity to pull into the Michigan State family, that's kind of been the last component of the decision, and I can say without a doubt. anybody that's around you is a better person because they're around you. And we look forward to a long, healthy, happy run together.
Yeah, we're very excited about the future and what it's going to bring. And, you know, it's just, you know, watching the NFL Combine, very proud of our players that are going off playing professional football, but also the guys that are going off like Ethan Rulin going to med school and those type of things. So, you know, our guys are making their mark, and, you know, we'll just continue to try and do that. And, you know, being a Spartan is such an important thing. I mean, it speaks volumes just in terms of how you carry yourself and what you need to try and accomplish. And that's the same for every big college football team or basketball team or athletic endeavor. But it's great to be a part of this, and we look forward to a long time here.
That was MSU President Luanna Simon and Athletic Director Mark Hollis with MSU Head Football Coach Mark D'Antonio, an interview from AM 870's MSU Today. Carl Goode is graphic artist in residence at MSU. His work at Newsweek magazine is currently on display at the Michigan Historical Museum. It's part of the exhibit entitled Put It on Paper through September 2013. WKAR's Peter Worf spoke with Goode about information graphics and the creative process.
I was the director of information graphics, those visual explainers, you know, maps, charts, diagrams, cutaways, everything, you know, at Newsweek magazine for 10 years. You know, there was a staff of 10 people in the department. I was the leader because I was the one most willing to take the fall if something went wrong. But, you know, we were there. I was the one in charge when the World Trade Center was under attack down the street, and we did all the diagrams of the buildings and explaining where the planes were hijacked from and their routes and all that visual stuff. I was never the most talented one in the room or the smartest. I was always the most enthusiastic, though, and I like to think that I helped to bring the team together with all the different skills to tell visual stories. And so that was a wonderful 10-year run at Newsweek, and then academia came calling, and so now I'm at MSU in the Department of Journalism.
Let's look at this infographic that comes from Newsweek magazine. This is a blown-up display here for the purposes of the Put It on Paper exhibit. And this is some of your work from Newsweek magazine that brings together an understanding of a certain time and a certain place in American history, particularly as it relates to Afghanistan.
That's right. You know, there are, you know, there was a lot going on in Afghanistan. There was a lot to explain before we went into Afghanistan. So I was asked if we could explain this particular week how the special forces worked in Afghanistan, how they were going to go in there and what they were going to do when they got in there. And so, when I start a graphic like that, I sketch. I do a lot of drawing and sketching because I generally don't know anything about the subject. It might be physics. It might be business. It might be military. It might be how to plant flowers in a garden so they bloom all day. I don't know anything about that. But I start asking questions as just the layperson about what I don't know, things I'd like to know, questions I have that any curious reader would want to know. And so that helps me to answer those questions.
And who are you asking these questions
of? Myself. Yeah. So that's what this first sketch up here does, the very rough one. It's just all these questions and ideas I have for filling in this graphic. And then I was going to see if I could answer those questions with experts.
We're looking at two large sketches, which I assume are in chronological order before the final product of this infographic. So beginning at the top, this is one of the first sketches. Can you describe a little
sketch.
Bit more? The first sketch.
Yeah, it's just a pen and ink sketch. And if you look along the top, you'll see a doodle up there because I really lost I'm ADD and I totally lost track of what I was thinking, or I didn't know what to think next or what question to ask. So doodling helps me relax that part of my brain that wants to be, you know, eating candy and, you know, watching movies, and so I can think with the other side. And so and I know our editor happens to love happened to love night revision goggles, you know, big central images. So I immediately just sketched a special forces guy in the middle with big night vision goggles. So I figured that'll probably anchor this thing. Okay. So I'm, in a way, I'm kind of combining design with content, with questions about the content, questions about the design. So I'm mixing them together like in a pot, like in a stew. I'm sort of, you know, not sure. And then I wrote all these questions around it about things that I'm wondering, like how, with a question mark, and overseas, where are these people? Where are they? Deployed, you know, what do they take with them? What do they do when they're in a country? So what my process for research was always to write a bunch of questions. Some you kind of, most of us know answers to some questions. You know, we like, the internet allows us to do our own research and inform ourselves to a point where now I can't find any more on the internet. I need to go call an expert, but I'm informed enough now to not sound like a moron when I'm talking to an admiral. Or a general, so, or whatever, a PR guy at the Department of Defense.
You have your foot in the door informationally.
I have my foot in the door informationally, and you don't want to waste this very precious time you finally get with this person who's going to answer some very important questions with dumb questions that you could have answered on the internet, like, what is a tank, you know?
Right.
You know, but people do that, you know, so what is a tank anyway? Did you even, like, read anything about what I do here?
So that's sort of the initial sketch. Now we're in phase two.
Then I did a more polished sketch that started to draw. You know, I'm an artist, so I could, but you know, you can still sketch without being an artist. You can still sketch out a concept. Like my wife always beats me at Pictionary, because if the challenge is to draw a horse, I'll
quickly,
right. And whoever answers the question, it's like charades.
Right.
I'll be so wrapped up in the details of what a horse looks like, the nostril and the mane, and trying to show off that I can draw a horse.
Right.
She'll draw a wedge with a point on top and her and horse, you know.
Right.
So you don't need to be able to draw well. It just has to communicate an idea. So when you're doing a sketch like this. So this is a more polished sketch, you know, more finished. And
it's starting to take shape here with this central figure of the soldier holding the weapon. That's going to eventually lead to the largest image.
Coming.
And the helicopters.
And the different equipment they're going to use there, with helicopters and doom buggies and you know, Stinger missiles and all that. Well, defenses against Stinger missiles on the ground, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Maps, world map, where they're deployed. All the things that I found interesting as a person.
And then what do you hope to achieve in the final product?
Well, the number one thing you hope to achieve is not making a mistake with the content. And we've made mistakes, you know. They say that journalism is history written on the fly. And, you know, you bang this stuff out and you hope you didn't make a mistake. You do the best you can to minimize those errors. So I want it to be right. The second thing I want it to be is clear, so that the reader feels like they can easily move through the information without, you know, being all crazy and scary. And then when they're there, you want them to have a great ride and feel like they walked away with something, like they feel smarter. For people that love info, it's like what Wired magazine calls their info porn. You know, it's like people are just, they love stuff like this. They eat it up. I'm no expert on anything. The reason I worked well for Newsweek was I was pretty in touch. I was a pretty average person. I was pretty in touch with the average reader's curiosity about anything. So I just tried to answer the questions, my own questions.
Carl Goode is graphic editor in residence at Michigan State University's College of Communication, Arts, and Sciences. Carl, thanks so much for the tour.
Oh, this was fun. Thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
That's Current State for today. Our show is engineered by Aaron Young. Joel Instroth is our producer. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State.